Tomorrow is Earth Day, an annual invitation to celebrate this beautiful planet and inspire our ongoing commitment to environmental and climate justice. Looking back, it's not a coincidence that the first Earth Day was held in 1970, 15 months after an astronaut became the first human to take a color photo of our planet. From our ordinary terrestrial perspective here on Earth, we are accustomed to seeing the sun rise when it's not cloudy. But this photo was taken from a lunar orbit. Above the horizon line of the moon's surface, we humans got our first glimpse of what it is like to see an Earth rise. That December 1968 photograph has been described as the single most influential environmental photo ever taken. Later in the service, we'll be singing our beloved UU hymn, Blue Boat Home. That song reminds us that seeing our planet as a shining blue marble in the inky blackness of space still has the potential to shift our perspective out of egocentrism and tribalism into a more global and cosmic consciousness. Beyond our very real and important differences from one another, this image has the potential to give all of us human beings a deeper felt sense of ourselves as all Earthlings. This worldview can open us up to existentially experiencing what our UU seventh principle calls the interdependent web of all existence, of which we are a part. And although we now know in retrospect how powerful a photo of the Earth from space can be, there was no widespread awareness of that in advance. NASA's original plans for the Apollo 8 mission were hyper-focused on the moon. Taking photos of Earth was rated as a, quote, lowest priority. But when astronauts got to space, they were almost immediately overcome by the thought that we came all this way to see the moon, and the most significant thing we are seeing is the Earth. This photo is also of our home planet, the Earth. It was taken by the Voyager 1 space probe from a distance of 3.7 billion miles away, about 40 times the distance of the Earth to the sun. As the cosmologist Carl Sagan wrote in his book, Pale Blue Dot, A Vision of the Human Future in Space. Have any of you read Pale Blue Dot? All right, I see a few hands. He writes, our posturing as humans, our self-importance, the delusions that we have some privileged position, they are challenged by this pale blue dot. Our planet is a lonely speck in the great enveloping cosmic dark. There is no hint that help will come from somewhere else to save us from ourselves. This distant image of our tiny world underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish this pale blue dot, the only home we have. All of those folks, I may actually do a sermon on this at some point, but all those folks like that want to go like terraform Mars, Mars is a disaster. Like, I mean, Mars is worse than like the most apocalyptic climate scenario. Like trying to live on Mars is... it's wild. We'll talk about it one day. So on this, I will not be signing up for that. But the radiation alone. But anyway, so on this Earth Day weekend, I don't want to be a Martian. On this Earth Day weekend, I invite us to spend some time reflecting on how we Earthlings might equip ourselves better for the long haul. How might we work together in coalition across our differences to act for ecological and climate justice, both for ourselves and future generations? My sermon is inspired by two books. The first is What We Owe the Future. It's by William McCaskill. He's a philosophy professor at the University of Oxford. He is 37. I know he looks pretty young, but if you're wondering, he and another philosopher coined the term long-termism. The idea that positively influencing the long-term future is or should be a key moral priority of our time. If humanity survives even a fraction of our potential lifespan as a species, then strange as it may seem, we will be the ancients. And our challenge is to be good ancestors. There are some powerful ways we can connect this idea of long-termism to the universalist half of our Unitarian Universalist tradition. Universalism started as this idea in the late 1700s of rejecting hell in a next world, and it evolved into loving the hell out of this world. A further evolution is widening our circle of concern beyond the vitally important work of improving the lives of all sentient beings alive today to also helping ensure the flourishing of generations to come. Our universalist ancestors, they pushed back against the teaching that the only motivation to be good is to, you know, avoid punishment in an afterlife. You know, I'm really scared of those people who sometimes say, I would like lie and cheat and steal if I weren't worried about going to hell. I'm like, you can actually just be good because it's an intrinsically good idea. but that being good only to avoid a bad afterlife is sometimes called fire insurance. But as it turns out, in the words of another philosopher, it turns out that willingness to endure suffering for the sake of a future reward, that is transferable from individual rewards to social ones. That's this whole idea of instead of individual justice to social justice. It's transferable from one's hope in one's own hope for paradise to hope for one's grandchildren and future generations. I'm just going to repeat that. A willingness to endure suffering for the sake of future reward, it is transferable from individual rewards to social ones, from one's hope for oneself to one's hope for one's grandchildren. I felt this shift in my own life. Growing up in a theologically conservative Christian congregation, I was taught to prepare for the next world after death with fear and with trembling. Good Paul, good Kierkegaard, right? That I needed to work out my salvation with fear and trembling. But as a UU, I feel called to work out my salvation right here and now and to do it with hope and with trust, not with fear and trembling. Can you feel the power of that paradigm shift? I'm going to read that quote from earlier one more time. That we are willingness to sacrifice for the sake of future reward. It is transferable from individual rewards in an afterlife to social ones right here and now, from one's hope for oneself to one's hope for one's grandchildren and for future generations. As the parent of a 10-month-old, I can feel that viscerally. I am willing to live differently if it means co-creating a better world for Jalen, who could live, if he lives even just a regular life span, you know, into like the early 2100s. We who are alive today are lifted up on the shoulder of giants who have come before. Our lives are better and easier in countless ways because the legion of inventors and activists and caregivers and more who are among our ancestors in the broadest sense of the word. As the saying goes, we drink from wells that we did not dig. We sit in the shade of trees that we did not plant. We profit from the sacrifice of persons we did not know. There's no way to pay back our ancestors, but we can pay it forward to future generations. As the Kenyan proverb puts it, treat the earth well. It was not given to you by your parents. It was merely loaned to you by your children. Or many of you may know the ethic of the seventh generation principle from the Iroquois Confederacy, which challenges us to make every decision to have it relate to the welfare and well-being of the seventh generation to come. We consider, will this action be to the benefit even of the seventh generation? That's five greats, great, 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 great grandchildren. McCaskill's book massively expands these traditional ethics to what he calls a million-year view. He really challenges us to think that humanity could have a very big future if we as a species are able to survive our collective adolescence, that is what we are in right now, and grow into a more mature version of ourselves, we may indeed find the future is very, very big. I encourage you to check out this book if you're curious to learn more. Tangentially, is anybody watching The Three Body Problem on Netflix? There's also a 30-episode version on Amazon, this like the Chinese version. I'm talking about the 8-episode one on Netflix from the co-creators of Game of Thrones. It's one of the most fascinating examples I've seen recently of exploring long-term thinking. And there's some significant environmental themes in this show, but it would take another sermon to get into the details. For now, on this Earth Day weekend, as we recommit ourselves to environmental and climate justice for the long term, we do have to ask ourselves, will our species have a chance to get to that long-term future? Consider this headline from the BBC a few months ago. We hit the world's first year-long breach of the key 1.5 degrees Celsius warming limit. That's the equivalent of 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. The period from February 23 to January of 2024 reached 1.52 degrees Celsius of warming. And with only 1.5 degrees Celsius, we've seen floods and droughts and heat waves and wildfires all over the world. This photo is from Chile, but closer to home, last summer, I, like many of you, I suspect, was shocked and troubled by the days of smoke-filled air here in Frederick from the Canadian wildfires. As our UU 7th principal states, we are in an interdependent web of all existence. And last June, those fires were way up there at the top of that photo up in northern Quebec, but we're all connected on this interdependent web, and there was serious impact to almost 2,000 miles away here at home, you know, way down that little red dot at the bottom of that photo. I could go on with more bad news, but instead I want to pivot to some potential good news. Although I'm a big fan of Will McCaskill's book, if I could convince you to read or listen to only one book in the wake of this Earth Day weekend, it would be this: Not the End of the World, How We Can Be the First Generation to Build a Sustainable Planet, by Dr. Hannah Ritchie. Like McCaskill, she is also around age 37. She's also an academic at the University of Oxford. She's a senior researcher in the Program of Global Development, as well as a data scientist who's the head of research at an organization called Our World in Data, who tries to kind of create charts to help us understand kind of what's going on in the world. Her book is short, it's accessible, it's evidence-based, it's quite inspiring. I encourage you to read it if this sermon leaves you curious to learn more. Surveys show that a growing number of young people ages 16 to 25 around the world increasingly agree with statements like, humanity is doomed, the future is frightening, or I'm hesitant to have children because of climate change. Ritchie is a professional scientist who has been immersed in climate research for many years. She is very much not a climate change denialist or a minimizer, but she's also concerned that this overemphasis on the possibility of apocalyptic and doomsday scenarios are not, there's some, in some places they're having the desired effect of scaring people into action. In other places, they're scaring young people into giving up hope and to just think, well, why even try? Because like the previous generations have already ruined it for the rest of us. Ritchie's book challenges us that while the problems we are facing are big and pressing, they are still solvable. We don't want to swing to the other extreme of being Pollyannas who think, oh, it's all just going to magically work out, because that very much may not be the case either. But we could potentially benefit from what is sometimes called urgent optimism, pragmatic optimism, realistic optimism, or impatient optimism. Here's an example she gives of what that means. She said, we're not talking about the sort of complacent optimism of like waiting for something that you know is almost definitely going to come. We're talking about a more conditional optimism, like a child who is thinking about building a treehouse. If I get some wood and nails and persuade some other kids to help, we could end up with something really cool. Along these lines, Ritchie casts a vision and outlines a plan to become the first generation that leaves the environment in a better state than we found it, the first generation in human history to achieve sustainability. Pre-industrial societies may have had much lower impacts on the environment, but they did not always allow everyone to live a good and healthy life. So it's important not to be too rosy about how things were in the past. Through the industrial and scientific revolutions, we have made huge advances in lowering life-threatening conditions like child mortality, maternal mortality, hunger rates, poverty rates. We have dramatically increased many life-enhancing conditions like life expectancy, access to education, and other basic resources. But many of these great advances have come at a massive cost to the environment and are unsustainable to continue in the way we are doing them. So the dream is sustainability. Our ancestors were never sustainable because they never achieved the first half of the dream, meeting the needs of the current generation. Half of all children died. Preventable disease was common. Nutrition was often poor. Today, the potential is within reach to make sure current generations have opportunities for a good life, that we shrink our environmental impact so that future generations have the same or better opportunities, and to let wildlife flourish alongside humans. If you read Ritchie's book, she's going to take you through a pretty accessible guided tour through seven areas: air pollution, climate change, deforestation, food supply, biodiversity, ocean plastics, and overfishing. I cannot take you through those seven areas today if we want to get out of here before, 2 o'clock. So I'll have to limit myself to a few highlights of actions we might consider taking. First, on the individual level, surveys show that many people think the most impactful actions they can take to mitigate climate change is recycling and upgrading light bulbs. Now, don't get me wrong. Do all those things, but you'll see on this chart that recycling and upgrading light bulbs are on the very bottom, the low impact activities on this chart. Some examples of actions that help the environment at a much greater level that are orders of magnitude beyond those actions in order of greatest to least impact would be giving up an SUV or any large vehicle with a low fuel efficiency and a high carbon footprint. Or consider, is it possible for you to go car-free or just drive a whole lot less? I can imagine a future in which you can actually, maybe not whether or not it's Uber or Lyft, we don't have to get into that, but where it's possible to like have an electric car show up just when you need it. You don't even have to buy a Tesla. You can just like have a AI-driven Tesla. AI is a whole other sermon. We can't get into that. It is coming, though, I promise. The day is coming when your Amazon's going to be delivered by drone. It's coming, people. Anyway, that's another sermon. Next down, eat a plant-based diet or eat lower on the food chain. Lab-grown meat is also going to increasingly help with some of this. Avoid a transatlantic flight, buy green energy, switch to an electric car. I also agree with Richie that in addition to wind and solar and geothermal and other green energies, responsible versions of much safer versions of nuclear power are very, very likely going to be needed to achieve a sustainable future for us and future generations. Now, as many of you have heard me say before, the most important advice I can give you on this Earth Day weekend is if any of you are feeling overwhelmed from any of those seven problems or other ones that I mentioned earlier, if you're feeling overwhelmed individually, the most important advice I can give you is to stop being one person. Join an organization, join a movement where you can work in coalition with others. We are stronger together. Here at UUCF, we have a climate change working group. More broadly in Frederick County, many UUCF members and friends are part of MACS, the Multifaith Alliance of Climate Stewards, or for the more radical among us, look into Extinction Rebellion, which is an environmental justice movement leveraging nonviolent civil disobedience to prevent biodiversity loss, social and economic collapse. There are many other wonderful groups acting for social and environmental justice. For now, I'll leave the last words to Dr. Hannah Ritchie from her book, Not the End of the World. She writes, "What makes us different from our ancestors is that economic and technological changes mean that we actually have options. We are not stuck with the default of whale oil or coal or cutting down trees or fossil fuels. We've developed alternatives that will allow us to do the same thing in a much better way. But a sustainable future is not guaranteed. What makes me most optimistic," she says, "is the number of people I meet who are pushing for this change. Surround yourselves with those people." She actually advises, just don't, your mileage may vary on this, but she says, just don't even bother arguing with a climate change denier. Focus yourself with the people who are working for climate change. She says, be inspired by them. We can build a better future for everyone. Let's turn that opportunity into reality. Let's turn the dreams into deeds. As we hold in our heart that vision, and as we discern within ourselves how we individually or collectively are called to respond in the wake of this Earth Day, rise, embody your spirit. Let's sing together hymn 1064, Blue Boat Home.